Greetings, and welcome back to the Rose Bros podcast. This episode, we are joined by Bob McNally, founder and president of Rapidan Energy Group, a provider of energy research and analysis for investors, global companies, and policymakers. Mr. McNally has over 30 years of government and market experience as an international energy consultant, senior White House policy official, and hedge fund strategist. He is the author of the award-winning and acclaimed book titled Crude Volatility, The History and the Future of Boom-Bust Oil Prices. He has testified before Congress on energy markets and national security, published on energy and foreign affairs, and has been interviewed by CNN, The Economist, NPR, Financial Times, Washington Post, New York Times, and other leading journals and programs. He is a non-resident fellow at the Columbia University Center on Global Energy Policy. And from 2001 to 2003, he served as the top international and domestic energy advisor for George W. Bush, holding the posts of special assistant to the president on the National Economic Council, and in 2003, senior director for international energy on the National Security Council. Mr. McNally earned his Bachelor of Arts / Bachelor of Science in Political Science and International Relations from American University, and a Master of Arts in International Economics and Foreign Policy from Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Among other things, we sat down and discussed advising U.S. presidents on energy policy, oil price volatility, the looming U.S. debt crisis, and why energy is more important than ever. Enjoy! This podcast episode is sponsored by Conate Water Solutions. Do you need cost-effective water sourcing options to supply your next drilling or completions program? Conate Water Solutions is a specialized hydrogeology company focused on water well drilling, testing, and water management services in Western Canada and Texas. Contact info at conatewater.com or check out conatewater.com for more details. This podcast is sponsored by headracingcanada.com. Looking for high-performance ski gear this winter? In partnership with four-time Olympian Manny Osborne Parody, HeadRacingCanada.com is offering the lowest prices possible through its online storefront by passing brick-and-mortar savings on to customers. Check out HeadRacingCanada.com for more info and get your high-performance ski gear for the upcoming season. Mr. Bob McNally, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to meet you, Trevor, and thanks for having me on.
For the listener, you are the CEO of Rapidan Energy Group.
Actually, the president. So my mother always said I wanted to be president growing up. We have another CEO. He's a great guy, Scott Modell, but I'm president of Rapidan Energy Group. Yeah.
For the listener, maybe we'll break the conversation up into two parts, Rapidan Energy, and then we'll get into some current events on energy. But to start from the top, what is Rapidan Energy?
Trevor, Rapidan Energy is a Washington, D.C.-based energy consulting firm specializing in the overlap of where market fundamentals, particularly in the oil and gas markets, intersect with energy policy and regulations and geopolitical risk. So it's sort of those three concentric circles, if you can imagine. I spent my three-decade-plus career, whether in the market or on the policy side in the White House, at the center of those three circles: markets, policy, and geopolitics. So our firm advises leading energy companies, investors, traders, governments on trends and developments in energy markets, again, weaving together those three drivers of energy: markets, fundamentals, fundamental analysis, policy regulation, and geopolitics. Our main focus is in, because where our colleagues are in Houston, Texas, and in the DC area.
How did you specialize in energy? Were you an engineer or technical in school, or did you work in industry for a long time?
No, my trip into energy was more of drift than mastery. I love history, and I, growing up, wanted to be a history teacher, especially military history. I didn't particularly like economics or math or anything like that. However, I didn't get rich while serving in our country's Peace Corps, a development program where you live in a developing country. I lived in Senegal, West Africa for over 2.5 years. And after that, I went to grad school and needed money. And I was hired by an energy consulting firm, oil consulting firm, to count barrels, basically. But again, I wanted to be a history professor. And so I learned, though, this was during the first Gulf War, how cool, how interesting oil was, right? How political and geopolitical it was. I knew that from my own history work, but there it was as I was counting barrels in 1991, 92. It was like, wow, energy is pretty interesting. In addition to the Gulf War and the price volatility from that, we had environmental regulations on gasoline, oxygenated fuels, and so forth. So I'm like, you know, I love politics, love history, love military history, and so forth. Oil's kind of cool. And then when I graduated, I looked at the pay scales of entry-level history teachers, oil analysts, my pregnant wife, and decided to go into oil, and there it was. And so I worked for that firm for a while, Energy Security Analysis, cut my teeth counting barrels, but then went to a hedge fund that had an office in D.C. that advised traders on policy and geopolitical drivers in all financial markets, both energy futures, but also macroeconomic stocks, bonds, currencies, and so forth. So I have a macroeconomic and energy background, more as an analyst. I went into the White House for 2.5 years, working for President George W. Bush from the very first day until 2003. An exciting time in energy. I was both his domestic and international energy advisor on the National Economic Council and the National Security Council. Everything from Enron to Iraq. It was a wild time there. I then returned to the hedge fund for 4 years, made partner, and then decided 14 years ago to step out and set up my own firm. My sense is that oil markets, policy, and geopolitics, really energy markets, policy, and geopolitics are becoming more interesting, not less, more political, not less. My unique background at the center of those three trends created, I think, some new entrant opportunities for consulting. So struck out and set up Rapidan Energy and haven't looked back and enjoyed every minute of it since. I was telling a colleague as we spent last weekend working on this Russian drama that our work, I think you'll find too, perhaps you find already, our work is often tiring, but never boring in energy. So that's a kind of a nutshell of how I got here.
When George H.W. Bush came up, energy was probably front and center of the economy. The critic would say it's kind of waned since then. Did you have a sense that energy is not maybe front and center of the economy, or maybe it's more so than ever? How has that evolution or that arc, how has that been working with all the Bushes and everything like that? Did you get a sense of that, or what was it like?
Yeah, I think the Bush administration marked, I think, the beginning of a historic new era in energy, where volatility and importance are much higher than any time since at least the 70s. With George H.W. Bush, you know, you had the Gulf War. So you had one, fortunately, fairly short-lived, but very dramatic and volatile episode that touched on energy. And, you know, George H.W. Bush wanted us to kind of get going on climate change and the Kyoto Protocol and so forth. So there were some environmental regulations. So energy was important, but really, I think the Gulf War was perhaps the only thing. But think about George W. Bush. I mean, you had during his administration a near quintupling of oil prices without a war in the Persian Gulf. I mean, the invasion of Iraq happened, but it didn't explain why crude oil prices went from about $30 a barrel in 2003. To over $150 a barrel in 2008. And climate change has become, especially since President Obama, his administration, and certainly with President Biden, you know, a huge factor and driver of energy policy, regulation, investment, and so forth. So we've seen in the last 20 years since I was in the Bush administration, it was like the opening of a dramatically more interesting, volatile, and portentous era in energy markets, policy, and geopolitics, for that matter, continuing right up till today and, you know, last year with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and record high gasoline prices. I mean, it just doesn't stop. So no, we're in a completely different world. Makes it very interesting. I tell younger folks who are coming and thinking about getting into energy, it's a great time to be a young person getting into energy, however you're doing it, analyst, advocate, industry worker, policy. It's just a great, really great time to be doing so. It was a bit sleepy in the 1990s when I was a younger person. You know, it was a bit, comparatively speaking, a little more docile. But now, never a dull moment. Space Mountain.
To kind of circle back to current events, oil prices nowadays, storage levels are maybe flat to down, depending on who you ask. But yeah, oil prices are, they dip below $70 this week, maybe hovering around $70. In your opinion, why aren't we at $100 oil yet? Or is $70 where we should be?
So I think the reason we're not yet headed towards $100 a barrel, and Rapidan's base case is that we will be on that road, you know, before too long, is the market is seized with the fear, the perception that there is a large risk of a material decline in economic growth. To say 2008 or an echo of 2008 is too strong. Their oil demand collapsed by almost 3 million barrels a day. But the ghosts of 2008 haunt us today. What do I mean? If you started the beginning of 2008, 2007, oil prices had risen sharply, you know, and you looked out the window, as we do today, and you look at the existing data in the oil market, you look at Chinese demand, you look at inventories, you look at Indian demand, gasoline demand in the United States, you don't see a real problem. In fact, you start to see, I would argue that inventories are on the tight side. And if you looked at the forecast folks were making in early 2008, toward the end of the year, as we do today, you look at the forecast we and others making now toward the end of the year, shows a tightening market. Right now, everybody's balanced, I'm aware of, just about everybody, shows huge inventory draws. Yet, what's interesting about now is almost everybody has a really tight oil balance, but no one's positioned for it. And why? And I think we go back to 2008. You know, you're at May, June, you know, $140 a barrel. 6 months later, you're at 35. Price of oil had collapsed. Why? Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers. A sudden implosion in economic activity. And with central banks raising rates and credit market conditions tightening, and this is after decades of lax monetary policy, with China being kicked off the world's supply chain for many things, certainly in energy, with a war underway in Europe, the risks to the economy are high. So it's understandable that financial market investors particularly are saying, the heck with this data, we're about to fall through the ice here. And we remember this from 2008. It's not the first time. So I think until the risk of a collapse in economic growth abates, and until we start to see in the data these material stock draws that we and others are projecting, we're probably going to be range bound. But in our base case, and again, I'm not saying it's 100%. I respect 2008 and the risk of a sudden implosion. It can happen, and if it does, you know, oil prices will drop. But our base case is that isn't going to happen. Maybe next year, the recession risk. Maybe next year, but we think the market is quite strong, and once these supply cuts materialize, you're going to see speculators cover their shorts, come back in and go long, and we're going to roof higher. I will say, you know, we're watching closely signs in the crude oil market, term structure, differentials, et cetera, that tell us these Gulf, especially cuts, are starting to come into place. And I think they are. You look at Murban, you look at Brent now, Dubai, Brent under Dubai. I mean, the differentials in the physical oil market are telling you you're starting to see signs that especially Gulf sour crudes are starting to become more scarce. The Asians are going to start pulling from the Atlantic Basin. Again, that's not enough alone to get us to where we think we're going. But if we start to see those material stock draws, we think the price will rise here sharply.
Everybody's been calling for a recession roughly the past year, but yet there is no recession yet. Or maybe we're partially in one. Housing prices are up, S&P's up, everything's up. Do you think we're headed towards a recession, or is it just fear?
I'm afraid we are, and it's mainly because of that 2 to 10 year curve. I'm not a macroeconomist, but that 2 to 10 year inversion is a pretty reliable indicator of a recession, at least in the U.S. Now, that doesn't mean we're heading towards 2008, though. U.S. oil demand we could growth could moderate if we have a moderate recession. A recession is two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. I mean, we could have that, you know, fourth quarter, first quarter next year, early next year. And if China's still up, you know, 900 a million barrels a day, and India's still strong, and this OPEC Plus is cutting, we think the Saudis are going to extend this voluntary cut. I mean, we could still have inventory draws with a technical recession. You really have to have a sharp downturn, we think, in economic growth, a real crisis for the oil market not to tighten materially. That risk is there. That's what I'm betting on. But yeah, the 10 to 2 year curve, the Federal Reserve is going up by at least two more rate hikes. You know, when they do this, it's almost like taking a step in a minefield, right? Where you don't know if your next step is going to be the last because you don't know where the mines are. And, you know, it could be SVB one day, a bigger bank another. And it's not just the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, the UK are raising interest rates. And that's like walking in a minefield. You have to respect the risk of a sudden systemic event in the financial markets hurting economic growth.
Those in the industry would say we're kind of in the era of a supply crunch where various pressures on the industry has reduced supply. Do you think we're in a supply crunch? Is that really impacting prices or is drilling down? Or to what extent is that impacting oil prices?
So this is a fascinating conversation. I'm going to be chairing a panel at the OPEC seminar next week, and we'll be talking about that with ministers and CEOs, you know, challenges and opportunities in investment. So you start off with people saying, we have underinvestment in energy, especially for hydrocarbons, and that's going to lead to a supply crunch. Now, that happens to be a view with which I strongly agree. However, I don't think folks often sort of unpack that enough. Now, if we think about it, if you look at the data on investment in the upstream oil and gas, obviously there's been a collapse in investment, right? From the $700, $800 billion a year to the $300, $400 billion a year from 2014 to about now, right? But that always happens when there's a bust. And we entered a bust phase literally on Thanksgiving Day in 2014 when the Saudis said, well, to Russia, well, if you won't help us cut under shale, then we're not going to cut and see you at lower prices. And we went all the way down to $26 a barrel in February of 2016 before the Russians said, okay, we'll join OPEC Plus. So we've been in a bust phase. We're entering, I think in the late 2021, we began entering what I call the foothills of the boom cycle. So, but let's get back to this underinvestment. What's really interesting about now, and it's unlike every other period, is consensus balances don't show an underinvestment. If you look at the IEA's medium-term oil market outlook, many other forecasts as well, they don't see an underinvestment problem. They see the collapse in investment. They don't see net oil supply growing by very much. But what's unique about now is they're saying that's not a problem. Why? It's on the demand side. Trevor, I think what's really missing in this debate is the focus on demand, right? The real reason that we're sleepwalking into this supply crunch is because many folks have been, I think, deluded and misled by the wishful thinking that passes for analysis now and forecasting by the IEA and others, that we're about to see this peak demand in oil. In other words, that electric vehicles are coming on stream so fast and fuel efficiency in gasoline and diesel-powered cars is rising so rapidly that global demand for oil is about to decelerate markedly this decade. I mean, the Energy Information Administration thinks that gasoline demand in the United States is going to peak this year and then collapse, right? And so if you believe that oil demand growth is about to decelerate sharply from the 1.5% a year that's been normal in a world growing at 3% to about a third of that rate, so 0.5% a year, a few hundred thousand barrels a day, if you believe that, then you look at the low investment and you don't say we have an underinvestment problem because we're not going to have the demand. So in my view, the next big surprise is not going to come on the investment or supply side. We all see the collapse in investment. Everybody sees that. It's going to be on the demand side. When we clear these infernal macroeconomic risks that are holding back demand, starting with COVID and now, I think we're going to kind of wake up in the next year or two and realize that demand is not about to peak, that electric vehicles, while growing strongly from a low base, are not coming on fast enough to crush demand for transportation oil and transportation. And vehicle fleet efficiency is widely overstated. In the United States, it has barely improved since 2014. During the bust phase, low oil prices, you see sort of flatlining in fuel efficiency. And that's what's really going to drive the next few years. So in my view, what's going to happen is we're going to be shocked that to find that demand growth for oil is much higher than consensus forecasters have been expecting, closer to 1.5 million barrels a day a year rather than 500,000 barrels a day a year. And if I'm right about that, Trevor, it won't take long for everybody to connect the dots between a demand growth of 1.5 and a supply, net supply of 0.5. Then the scales will drop from the eyes, the clouds will part, you know, the trumpets will blare, and everybody realizes we are structurally short oil and we do have an underinvestment problem. But there again, we're sleepwalking into it because many folks are drinking the green Kool-Aid about this miraculous peak in oil demand, you know, by 2030, 2035, which implies the demand growth rate is going to slow down. That's going to be the next big surprise. I don't think it gets enough attention in the discussion.
Something I've been thinking about lately is what Nassim Taleb would call fooled by randomness, where we like to assign narratives to things, but in reality, it's random and there's no real reason behind it. The nature of commodities, they're up and down, and it's really hard to predict in complex systems. Some people will get a call right and kind of ride their coattails the rest of their career on some commodity call. To what extent does that play into energy calls, and how do you guard yourself against it? And what's the antidote to detecting that in other people?
Great question and frank question. So my wife will tell you I'm quite fallible and can make mistakes and have made bad calls. Two of the best calls I've made was predicting the quintupling of oil prices while I was at Tudor, and then the collapse in oil prices after 2014. In fact, Pioneer Natural Resources was kind enough to write in their history book that I helped them with this and so forth. So, but I made bad calls. For me, you know, I think the key thing and the challenge is first discerning where the consensus is on an issue, and second, discerning where the consensus is wrong and when and how it'll flip. That to me is the challenge. And all those are challenging. Folks tend to overlook the first one. I don't want to listen to other people or read other stuff. I just want to focus on my own views, right? Wrong. You have to spend a lot of time figuring what the consensus was. In 2014, especially, the consensus thought that Saudi Arabia would cut under shale indefinitely. I just knew that was wrong. I didn't know exactly when the market would realize that, but I did get that call right. And so, you get a call right, you know, your reputation goes up and so forth. Then it's, what have you done for me lately? What's your next call? But, you know, it's sort of like being maybe your listeners don't like to hunt, but like a hunter. You know, if you're sitting there in a tree and you're waiting for the prey to come into the field, you can't will the prey into the field. You can't just say, okay, for my next magic trick, I'm going to do this or that, because there may not be that that combination of a wrong consensus and then your accurate understanding of where the consensus is wrong and where it's going to flip. I strongly believe I'm going to be right about this peak demand not happening. And I strongly believe in that view. But comes the timing question, when to put it on. Right now, really, in the face of 2008 risk, I mean, I have to recognize, look, I know I'm going to be right about this boom cycle. But timing it and entering it, that's the hard part for me. Now, I will say this, though. You said random walk and so forth. My study of the oil industry, though, suggests there's been an extraordinary amount of discipline and stability and governance and certainty that entered into that oil market in history. Oil is wildly prone towards price volatility because of intrinsic inelasticity of supply and demand, and inventories help, but they're neither costless nor infinite. So it's wildly prone towards volatility. But, and this is my book, if you'll allow me to plug Crude Volatility, again, where I got to marry my love of history with the love of the energy markets and go back and try and make sense of why you're seeing things like a quintupling in oil prices 20 years ago without a war in the Persian Gulf, and how oil can go from $100 a barrel where it had been for 3 years from 2011 to 2014 to 45 in 6 months without a recession, without Saudi Arabia increasing production. They didn't increase production in 2014. They just said, we're not going to cut. Okay. What explains that unusual amplitude of swings, but also the causes? They're not usual recessions. And so I wrote crude volatility. You have to go into history. And what it found was, you know, especially ironically, Texas, Americans, Texans, people put on earth by God to produce oil and gas and limit the role of government in business, right? These are what Texans are there for, Oklahomans as well. I dare say Canadians, Western Canadians, Albertans might be a little bit similar. They love to produce oil and they don't really like a lot of government regulation. Okay, Texans in the 30s, to banish this oil price volatility, resorted to supply control. It was extraordinarily successful, but extremely intrusive. The Texas Railroad Commission regulators would meet every month after month for 40 years and impose quotas field by field, well by well. None of this statewide stuff or countrywide stuff. No. And they kept oil prices smooth as a glacial lake, even despite huge imbalances. The 1950s was actually the biggest period of imbalance in the oil market history. You had the Saudi fields coming on, Russian, Soviet fields increasing, but you hadn't had that explosion in demand that happened with the car culture in the 1960s. As a result, the Texans had to hold 20% of world production was kept in spare, and another 15% was held offline by the majors in the Middle East. Just think about that for a second. One-third of the world's oil production capacity was held in spare in the 1950s to keep oil prices stable. Think of any commodity on earth, much less one as important as oil, the lifeblood of modern civilization, where regulators will shut down production capacity immediately, indefinitely, to keep oil prices stable. I can't think of one, yet we did. No wonder that the founders of OPEC literally tried to copy and learn from the Texas Railroad Commission. So now we see the opposite. We're in an era where there is no effective swing producer. OPEC Plus has had its successes. It's having success now. It's had its failures, as we have seen. I believe we, especially as we go forward, the OPEC Plus will not be able to stabilize oil prices. That spare production capacity, 35% of the market in 1950s, is, 3% now. And I think it's going to disappear when this peak demand doesn't happen. So I would just say with commodities, because of its importance, and you ask yourself, why would people like Texans who love to produce oil and hate government regulation resort to a heavy-handed government control that Mao Zedong would have said, hey, hang on, guys, relax, leave a little room for the private sector. You guys are going too crazy. Why? Because they wanted to enforce price stability for the world's most important, certainly energy commodity, perhaps commodity, because even our agriculture depends on oil and gas. So I would just, on that, I would say we've done it before. I don't know that we're going to do it anytime soon, but we have banished the random walk in oil because oil's too important, was considered to be too important. But now people think, oh, we're peaking, oil's like horses and buggies in 1905, electricity's coming. So there's this nonchalance, there's this dismissiveness towards oil that I think is going to be sort of shattered in the coming years as its importance comes back.
Perhaps if you study history and look for the clues, there are causal relationships that can be established and conclusions that can be made to establish a career. And it's not all just random.
It's not all just random. At times, the government, especially the industry, can come in and impose order and stability. It's tough to do. Who likes sacrificing your own market share to support the economics of your competitors? Nobody likes doing that. Why do you do it? Because the alternative is worse. Wild, extreme price volatility for the most important commodity, my biggest, widely traded commodity on earth. That's why you do it.
Charlie Munger would suggest we should be drilling and taking oil or importing oil from other countries, and that we should be leaving our own oil in the ground. It's too important of a resource to use our own supplies up. What's your opinion on that? Should the US be and Canada be consuming its own oil, or should we be looking elsewhere throughout the world to protect our own interests?
Well, now we come to humility. Nobody knows how long the oil era will last. We can debate the consensus, and we just have, the oil era is not going to end anytime soon, as the consensus wants to believe. But I think, you know, to make a decision about how Canada or the United States should manage its resources, that requires clairvoyance about what's going to happen in 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 years. And my study of history, my work, 3 decades, the more I learn, the less I know, and the more interested I become in the subject. That's crazy. We don't know. We thought oil demand was going to peak in the 1950s. You know, Hubert King did, you know, and in the early, by the early 70s, we thought in the 50s and 60s, it would peak by the early 70s. It did for a while. And then lo and behold, shale came along. So no, I don't think we have the knowledge and the ability to forecast to make decisions about whether we should keep it in the ground or not. I believe in free trade and economics and market forces should drive our decisions largely. We should have strategic reserves and emergency powers for wars and things. But other than that, it's a global oil market. We ought to be offering our reserves and our you know, into that market. We should be trading freely and satisfying demand at home and abroad. And, you know, export markets for Canada and the United States are very important for the health of the industry. The president of the United States does have the power to restrict or ban product exports or crude if he wanted. Could he do that? Sure. What would happen? You'd have a collapse in investment, refining capacity, production that would hurt not only our trade partners, but eventually our own consumers. So it's folly to think that Canada, the United States can sort of isolate itself from the global energy markets. And other than times of war, we ought not do that, in my view. Very, very, very foolish, and it presupposes an ability to forecast and understand the future, which is way beyond human grasp.
On the subject of Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett, they're often known to be buying mispriced assets. The energy industry has been mispriced the last 5-10 years. I think Warren Buffett owns roughly 30% of Oxy now. But the question is, why has energy been so mispriced? Why is it undervalued? And what do you think is the catalyst to correct that undervaluation?
I do believe oil and gas, especially companies, are very mispriced. And I think those valuations are going to rise sharply in the future. The main reason they are mispriced is twofold. One, a bust phase. Look, we either have a swing producer and we don't. From 1932 until about 2004, 2005, 2006, we had a swing producer. And that brought relative stability to the oil markets. There was still up and down, and there were still cycles and investment cycles and so forth. My colleague Arjun Murthy is very eloquent on this. But when you don't have a swing producer, you have these wild price swings and these multi-year periods of booms and busts. And they reinforce each other. The busts discourage investment, encourage consumption, that then lead to these imbalances that are resolved through higher prices, because again, oil supply and demand are very inelastic. So the reason people are so down on energy is we entered a bust phase from 2015 to 2021. Shale investors burned capital. We shipped great shale production, not great returns. And so that's the main reason. That would happen. That's just what happens during bust periods. The challenge, Trevor, is we don't have a lot of familiarity with this in living memory. You have to go back to the period between 1911 and 1932, the last prolonged boom-bust era in history, for when we saw this kind of behavior. So it's kind of new. I'm not surprised that folks are surprised. The second reason, as we discussed, in addition to the bust phase sort of pessimism, which you always see, and actually when it gets acute is a sign of a bottom, right? In addition, what's unique now is that the consensus believes oil and gas are about to die. They are about to be displaced by electricity, especially in transportation for oil. And you either believe that's correct or you don't. So that is sort of exacerbating the negativity that comes anyway from the bust phase, right? So poor returns, you're depressed, you don't see a future. Now the world's telling you this is a asset that's about to become stranded. Anyone investing in a new oil and gas field has got to be out of their minds, because the world is about to drive towards a fast transition to renewables. We should be investing in lithium, cobalt, copper, not oil and gas. That's the prevailing wisdom. Those are the two reasons why we see this mispricing of oil and gas. Both of those, you know, there's a life cycle for every idea. And I think this idea that oil and gas are on their deathbed is about to die, and peak demand itself as an idea will peak. And when we see a peak in peak demand consensus, I think the market will return, capital will return, politics and policy will return, and you'll see this growth area. Final point I make on this in politics, you know, President Biden came in, one of the first things he did, aside from joining the Paris Agreement, was to cancel the Keystone pipeline between our two countries. One of the most recent things he did was greenlight Willow, a new greenfield oil field in Alaska. You couldn't have two different policies, right? The first thing was demanded by environmentalists for the sake of climate change. The second thing was a sin, according to environmentalists. I mean, the last thing we should be doing, the IEA says we should no longer be approving new greenfield oil and gas projects, period, end of story, if we want to get to net zero. Yet President Biden just did. What does that tell you? That tells you it's a sign, I think, and there are other signs. Look at Shell. Shell is deciding, we're sick and tired of having this weak valuation versus our peers, Chevron and Exxon. We're going back to producing oil and gas. We're not going to destroy ourselves by misallocating capital to activities that we're not good at, you know? I think BP is going to be following behind. Okay, so you see these signs that the industry, capital, investors, policy is starting to swing back to realize we can't do this, keep it in the ground. We're not about to see peak demand. And I think that's a trend that you're going to see continue. And those of us who are positioning for higher valuations in oil and gas industry are going to be pretty happy campers.
One of the fears of people in the industry is that people like OPEC, although maybe not as influential as they used to be, or perhaps they are willing to cut production just to send a message. Do you think that people like OPEC are still widely influential and that can really influence the price? Does that worry you? How do you think about that?
The irony is that swing producers or supply managers, whether it's the Texas Railroad Commission, OPEC, or OPEC Plus, are necessary to preserve some modicum of price stability. And that price stability, at least some anchoring of long-term prices in a range, it's never perfectly stable, is absolutely necessary for investment and for consumers, right? People who use oil, we're buying long-lived, big CapEx equipment, airplanes, car. Okay. So I look at them more as a necessary intrusion of the government. I work for Port George W. Bush. I don't like government intervention in principle. But in this case, my research, my analysis, my conclusion, my experience is that it's a necessary thing. And so I don't think they cut production or increase production to send a message. I think they do it with the goal of maintaining price stability. And to do that, they have to prevent imbalances, right? The leading indicator of price instability is when you get inventories really high or really low. So at the end of the day, I think OPEC Plus leadership, just like the Texas Railroad Commission, they wake up every day and they think about supply, demand, and inventories. And they worry about whether or not we're generating imbalances in the market that could lead to prices becoming wildly unstable. I think that's what they really do. They are more influential when there's a bust, when there's oversupply, Trevor. And think about that, right? If there's too much oil on the market and you're the regulator, you have the choice. You can say, let's cut. I'm going to cut supply and maintain price stability. That is what OPEC plus Saudi Arabia are doing now. That's what, you know, the Texas Railroad Commission did in the 1950s. Or you can say, you know, nah, we're not going to cut. Maybe you disagree. I want you to cut more than me. I'm not going to cut it. No, you share. And we may get into a fight with your swing producer group because there's usually a number of them. You say, you know what? I'm not going to cut alone. That's 2014. That led to that collapse in oil prices. That's March of 2020. Not only did they not agree to cut, they increased production. Prices went to, at one point, negative $37 a barrel. Okay. So we have instances where, but if you're oversupplied, at least there's the choice. But here's the real interesting thing. Where you don't have a choice, where supply managers are less influential, is in booms. When did the Texas Railroad Commission abdicate? It wasn't in an oversupply. It was in a boom, 1960s, early 1970s. 1972, the Texas Railroad Commission threw in all its spare production capacity. Demand was rising too fast. It lost control in a boom. OPEC. Not OPEC Plus, but OPEC, which took over from the Texas Railroad Commission. It lost control in 2008. Saudi Arabia threw all its spare capacity in the summer of 2008. You needed a great recession to finally bring prices down. So the kings, the supply managers, they lose control in booms. They're not as influential in booms because they don't have a choice. They simply run out of production capacity. They don't have any spare left. I believe that's where we're headed this decade. There is about 3 or so million barrels a day of spare production capacity now. I don't believe demand's about to peak. Net supply is going to be constrained by this investment collapse that we talked about. So I think we're going to get into a situation where demand's going to exceed supply. Saudi Arabia, UAE, Iraq, countries with a little bit of spare, they're going to put that spare in and prices are going to boom. And I just hope, and it's bad for the industry because the boom then causes the bust. So I'll leave with this, or one final thought is, what one thing I think we might want to hope for the industry and frankly for the global economy, is that we have a more moderate GDP growth and we don't have that 1.5 million barrels a day demand growth. If it's, you know, closer to a million, if we have a more moderate GDP growth, then we'll have a longer and maybe a less volatile boom phase. It's still going to be a great phase for the industry. And we're going to the $100 barrel range. It's going to be awesome. But we should hope to avoid the kind of crazy spikes that we saw like in 2008 that can then lead to busts.
I read one of your tweets the last few weeks, and the idea was, what you're saying is one of the biggest threats to energy companies is the looming federal debt crisis in the USA. How come you think that?
So I just look around. You know, when I talk to my clients, and at some point on, if we have an interview, I'd like to show you a slide, but I show a slide of federal debt held by the public as a percent of GDP from the Congressional Budget Office down here, government data and forecast. And it shows basically that, you know, a hockey stick, kind of with three bumps. You have the revolution, the Civil War, World War II, and then it goes off the charts. It's forecasting. And I say to my clients, especially in the energy industry, for your balance sheet, for your business operations, for your profits, this is the hockey stick chart you need to worry about. Not that hockey stick chart that they show with temperatures over the millennia and going up, which is controversial. And I say that's more important for a couple of reasons. The public and the government care a lot more about the debt and government programs than climate change. That's just true. Perhaps more true in the United States than in Europe, and maybe Canada than in Europe, but it is true. The reason the debt is about to explode is not a war, which caused it in the past. It's that the United States government has promised tens of trillions of dollars of benefits to the elderly through Social Security and Medicare that aren't in the tax code. It's a pyramid scheme, and pyramid schemes are always very popular before they're revealed to be pyramid schemes, but then they go bad. And then this one's going to go bad. And so the reason the very conservative government forecasters are forecasting a catastrophic explosion in the debt is not because of a war, not because of weak economic growth, not because of a pandemic, because of this catastrophic mismanagement of the government's finances. Now, the polls show that the public cares a lot about Social Security, a lot about Medicare, much higher than climate change. And so as we enter this debt crisis, which in my view is mathematically much more certain than a climate crisis, the modeling is just simple math. It's just demographics and pay scales and so forth. It's not, an 11-year-old could understand it. But it's going to be much more powerful as a driver of our politics. And the solutions to that may include, depending if the left wins, you know, huge tax increases, including on the energy industry and individuals and so forth. So in my view, if you look out the next few years, the obvious crisis barreling toward us is not climate change. I'm not discounting climate change. I worked on all kinds of alternative energies for George Bush, from fusions to residential solar tax credit. I lived a zero carbon footprint in the Peace Corps for 2 years. I bought a hybrid car. I was an early adopter. I don't need lectures from anybody about working on clean energy. And I believe human activities are contributing to the climate changes, and it's a problem, an externality we have to address. So I'm not saying it's not a problem. But just as an analyst, what's coming at us is a debt crisis. That is going to roil politics. And with that, consequences for taxation and regulation of energy, much more than climate change, in my view. And so that, to me, is by far the clearest and most present danger to energy companies is the looming debt crisis.
Problem is that people will call you Cassandra in the meantime. How do you illustrate that to the average Joe? Is it just simple math like you're suggesting, or graphs, or how do you deal with it in a pragmatic way?
Well, you know, it's like the old, you know, song, it's a bet, lay it down. I mean, you make your call, right? You look at trends, you look at events. Look, I wish it was climate change, mm-hmm. because that's my issue. It's an energy issue. I don't particularly like budget issues, Social Security, Medicare, but look, I'm an analyst. With the exception of the Peace Corps and working for President Bush, those 5 years, I've spent my entire 32-year career just trying to predict stuff, whether I like it or I don't like it. I've had successes and I've had failures. But I've learned a few things over the years. You know, these crises, I think, are foreseeable. And this one isn't that hard. The only way you can look at the debt forecast in the United States and not see a looming crisis is if you believe in this modern monetary theory. You believe that the debt really doesn't matter because we'll print it in dollars. And as long as the government controls inflation, we can do that ad nauseum and it doesn't matter. This is not a widespread theory. Some people believe it. But if it's true, then I'm wrong. Or you believe that, relax, Congress is going to get together and simply raise taxes on working people to the tune of tens of trillions of dollars to pay for this. Or they'll just cut benefits and we'll do it in a couple legislative sessions. And it'll be, I don't think it's going to be that easier either. Okay, so I look back and I say that chart, and it's too bad I can't show it. Maybe if I send it to you and you want to upload it here. But there's simply one chart. You just look at it and you realize that's the crisis that's coming. That's the foreseeable crisis, right? There are known unknowns, right? Or there are unknown unknowns. There are things that, you know, we don't know. Will we have another pandemic? Will we have a war with Russia or China? Who knows, right? But this is something that's staring us in the face. It's just math, demographics, and extant public policy. It's not hard. And we know it's concerns matters that are much more important to the voters and to elected officials than climate change. So I just connect those dots and say, I think that's going to hit you a lot sooner than climate change policy will. I mean, when you look around the world, do you see politicians willing to impose costly policies on their voters for climate change? I don't see that. How long did that little diesel tax in France last in 2018 with the yellow vest protest? Look at the Ukraine stress test. What happened when gasoline went to $5 a gallon? Europe, some of the most climate-forward countries and states, started increasing subsidies for fossil fuels, opening up lignite plants, reducing taxes on oil and gas. Germany and Italy reduced their fuels taxes to the lowest levels allowed under EU laws, and those taxes finance renewable power. Okay, so what happens when the going gets tough? What happens when real work is called for in climate? They run away. Joe Biden, he's a proving willow now. He's spilling the SPR and begging the shale industry to increase production. What's up with that? He came in canceling Keystone, saying keep it in the ground, okay? Reality forces change and imposes sort of lessons and consequences on elected officials. And so the reality is we're heading towards a debt crisis. And that's going to impose certain consequences that are, I can't foresee them exactly, but I'm pretty sure we'll be talking a lot more about that than we will climate change in the coming years. Mm-hmm.
Problem is, if there is another global crisis of any sort, when you have such a high debt level, it doesn't leave you much room for error. There's no margin for safety in the U.S.'s case.
Precisely. If you start from a high debt and you have a war, you have an economy crisis, you want to finance a green transition, whatever it is you want to do, harder to do unless the U.S. can just keep issuing, you know, dollar debt at zero interest rates forever. We got used to that. We got hooked on the opium of low interest rates and endlessly costless increases in our debt. Those days are over. And some hard realities, budget realities, are going to come and impose themselves. And again, it's not necessarily good for the oil and gas industry. If the left wins and says, we need to go kind of a direction of Mexico and Venezuela here. We need to nationalize this industry. Because the industry is going to make huge profits. I tell them the biggest risk in this decade, think about it. If I'm right about peak demand, they're going to make huge profits this decade. They'll be sitting on these profits at a time when a debt crisis is going to intensify. Hungry, angry governments are going to look at those fat profits and say, I want those. Okay. The industry is going to have to defend their profits from hungry and starved governments trying to fill massive gaps in their fiscal policies that they can't do with debt anymore.
Yeah. Well, that's a great conversation. I know you don't have all day, but to maybe leave the listener as an energy expert, what do you see as the biggest opportunity for energy investors going forward? And on the flip side, what do you see as the biggest risk?
I still see enormous opportunity for investments in oil and gas, including refining. While we're underinvested in the upstream, and that tightness will largely drive the boom price cycle to come, I think refining, North American refining, I think is a great place to look because the demand that's not going to peak this decade is mainly gasoline and diesel as transportation fuel. I think folks are pretty realistic about LPG, industrial fuels, and so forth, petrochemical feedstocks. But it's the surprise that's coming is on the good old gasoline and diesel. And by the way, if gasoline demand is revised higher in terms of the consensus thinking, that leaves more headroom for biofuels and, you know, some renewable biofuels, renewable diesel to grow as well. So I think that's the place to position. I think companies that have bet the farm or even a major pasture or two of the farm on a quick transition, they're more likely to be the stranded asset later this decade than an oil and gas field. I think capital has moved too fast, too quickly, based largely on hope and expectation that policy can and would drive a quick transition. I think that idea has started to come under enormous pressure, starting in late 2021 as oil prices started to rise, certainly now with the Fed rate hikes, with war, and so forth. And I think we're going to see political and financial and economic changes that challenge that premise. So I wouldn't want to be a very leveraged, exposed investor in geared towards this sort of quick collapse in demand for oil and transportation. I'm speaking more on the transportation side here. The power, I don't have as strong a view, wind and solar, but policymakers are going to be distracted by other issues going forward. Capital and debt is not going to be as cheap as it was. Energy prices are going to be higher, and this is going to be a much more difficult environment, I think, for some of these investments in, geared towards, again, quick transition to electricity and automobiles. That's what I'd be more concerned about.
Well, that's a great conversation. If anybody wants to find you, you are on Twitter and also at rapidenergy.com, I think it is.
Rapidenergy.com. That's right. Rapidenergy.com on Twitter, on LinkedIn. Trevor, again, thank you for your terrific podcast series and so forth. My colleagues and I are big fans. Thank you for having me on. And, hope we can do it again.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time. So we can end there.
Great.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Hopefully you enjoyed the episode. If you liked what you heard, check out rosebros.ca, where we will have upcoming shows. Until next time, happy coffee drinking.